You are listening to the Furler Bros Tech Podcast, episode 266, a visionary podcast with a new line of hardware.
Six of episode 266 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Too many ofs in that sentence. Today is October the 30th, 2016. And I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and my terrifying brother is James Furlough. I'll get there eventually.
You're working it. You're working it. That's totally fine. So I've skipped over. Let me think here. Over Halloween and Thanksgiving. And I just went straight to the eggnog. So that's what I'm imbuing today.
I'll ask the classic pretentious question. So does it have alcohol in it?
No, it's from when in their mass drink it section.
Gotcha. I'm starting to get excited about...
Is that pretentious to ask? I was expecting you to ask if it was homemade or not, but...
Oh, yeah, no. Well, yeah. I pulled back, because normally the really delicious thing is like, how's the out... You know, you're supposed to assume there's alcohol in it.
Mm.
If it's homemade, you can't have homemade alcohol, or... you can have homemade alcohol. You can't have homemade... Eggnog without alcohol, because it's the only way to thin it enough to drink it.
I use milk to thin it usually. The other reason why I've skipped over Halloween and Thanksgiving is because I had Christmas last Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. According to my watch, it was time. Brand new. I got my Apple Watch on Friday.
Oh, I gotcha.
Living the dream.
I was having such a hard time following you. Yeah, that's right. You got the new Nike Apple Watch.
Nike Plus. At the moment, I've got their Volt Green. It's Sunday. I just came from church, and I have the analog watch face on. But on the other day, which would be Saturday, I had more of their traditional digital view. Super exciting. Apparently I'm doing okay on my activities. I'm about halfway, 49% of my move goal, 33% of my exercise, which I'm like, I don't even know when I did that. 41% of my stand goals. So, you know, I'm making it work.
Nice. Nice. Have I ever told you what my strategy is with watch faces? I can technically read an analog watch, but okay. Like I can't tell what time it is by shape. I have to look at where it's pointing at the hour hand. Then I have to look at where it's pointing at the minute hand. Then I have to put those two numbers. Well, people who are like accustomed to reading analog clocks, they just kind of look and they can just see the shape and they know what time it is. Oh. Like there's a geometric correlation there. Whereas me, I actually have to go through a step. Therefore, I'm very slow. I can't glance at an analog watch and read it. Whereas
I'm slow too.
Who
are these people? Really?
Old people. Whereas I can glance at a digital clock and know the time in a moment. So what I do,
just as fast as these older people.
Exactly. So what I do is with the analog clock faces, for the one of the complications, I always put the current like local time.
Nice.
So that I have in the corner in a small print the current time as a digital. But it looks like I have an analog.
Wow, talk about pretentious.
I know. Hey, you know, it's style.
I get it. I totally get it. Hey, I'm on top of it, but I can read an analog clock, so we're good. So I got it. It's fun. It's connected to my phone. I set a timer today using it. The Hey Siri feature is awesome.
Which it is quite nice.
Great.
That was funny.
Don't listen. So it's good. It's all good. It's feels good. I have a Link bracelet that I got that I need to get resized because it's just a little big. How many holes on your band do you? I feel like that's a question to ask now.
What do you mean?
You know, on your on the
my smart band.
Yeah, on your smart band or whatever.
No,
how many?
The sports band.
Sports band. There we go.
I'm like three holes? In.
3 in. Okay. I'm like 5 in. Could be different size.
The other way. I'm like 3 from the inside. I think we're at the same place.
Oh,
I'd have to check.
I don't know. My holes go all the way to the top because I have the Nike Plus sports band.
Oh, gotcha. So give me a second.
That math doesn't work for me. But I could see if you were that way, you would want to count it opposite.
1, 2, 3, 4. I got one. Yeah, I'm on the fifth hole. The same hole.
Fifth hole. Hey, we have the same size wrists.
What? This is super fascinating conversation. I'm really excited to know what your take is on Apple stuff later in the show.
Okay.
Because Apple announced all their stuff, and it's just...
You know, I was thinking about this. I literally have their latest phone, their latest iPad, their latest watch right now. And
right.
I'm thinking about getting... I'm more than thinking about getting an Apple TV, so I would have the latest of that. And I'm like, man, if I upgrade the computer, like, I will be this special place in time where I would literally have all of their latest products, which I feel like is normally impossible with them.
Yeah,
but somehow which is
worth noting.
What it really means is like a year or two from now, I'll be really depressed. All my stuff is so old.
I know. Yeah. Well, especially because for me, it's like I am at least 6 months to a couple of years behind on every single one of their product categories. And I'm starting to get into the things that are going to be needed to be upgraded. And I get a little more of the critical, well, Apple's not my only option because I'm not. So I'm just looking forward as we talk about what happened this week to see the difference.
Yeah, because a lot did happen this week.
I know. So instead of theorizing about it, and let's just jump into it, James, where this week, like every week, we're going to be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
I founded and work for an OEM that makes a new category of devices, or is going to make a new category of devices, specifically that is HPI, and they are going to ruin an industry before it happens. That's maybe not true, but maybe true. We'll talk about it. However, we'll I do not represent...
I don't have any idea what you're talking about, and I'm really curious now.
I do not. Okay, how about this one? I do not physically or virtually represent HPI or any of HPI's opinions. I also own part of Twitter, some of their dying companies, Etsy, and the Lending Club. I can say that, Lending Club.
All right, nice. I own a share of Skull Candy, I think.
And share. I think I can check that on my watch. Well, not for you personally, but I can check my stocks on my watch somehow.
Nice.
I think that's a thing. I'm still trying to figure out why I would want to do that. But
if you're a day trader, I don't know. I've had stock prices on my watch before. It's just like, oh, cool, I can do this. And I eventually got to the point of, why would I do this? This is
question. If I delete an app from my watch, can I still get notifications for it?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's like that one. I'm like, do I need it? I don't know. It's weird deciding what apps deserve to be and which ones don't. And it's a whole new, like, thing of, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say.
It just takes time, James. Just enjoy the process. It's a journey, not a destination. But
okay,
if you want to follow us on our daily journey throughout the week, you can follow us. We're up on the social media. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is NextWiggin4, where sometimes I get caught on planes where the oxygen masks drop during the middle of flights.
That's crazy.
I know, right? It was pretty nuts. It was an exciting time. I think my favorite part about it was once it became clear that it was an accidental deployment and we weren't actually in the middle of an emergency and we weren't all going to die a fiery death, which is of course what you're expecting to happen the moment those things pop out of the roof.
But like as soon as it happened, before anybody had relaxed, everybody was pulling out their phones to take pictures. It was like, it's a weird time to be alive. but yeah, good times. Go to my Instagram if you want to see a selfie of me with my oxygen mask on an airplane. It's there.
James Furlow at twitter.com, Instagram, elsewhere, which, yeah, I'll post a picture of my watch so you can see what it looks like.
Nice. Also, if you want to read more, go deeper on any of the things that we talked about this week, seeing the videos, listening to the audio clips, anything along those lines that comes up, we will be posting it to furlowbros.com/266. And yeah, go check out that. Go take a look. See, it's pretty nice. We're proud of it. Yeah. So do you want to, are you just sitting there playing with your watch?
No, I'm not. I was taking a picture of it, posting it, so it would be there like I promised. So, yeah. I want to talk about two related articles, if that's okay. Kind of get deep and heavy right out the gate here. It was the Vox came out with this article that was talking about the productivity paradox and why, and this maybe are, you know, up for debate, but why we're getting more innovation but less growth. And I thought it was actually really interesting. He talks about the effect that innovation has on different industries. And so one of the things that he said is, like, with textiles, when textiles first came out, textiles used to be made by hand, right?
Yes.
And so people owned very few clothes. You'd have, you know, just maybe one or two pairs of things because you had to make it all yourself. And then eventually manufacturing enabled the ability to make textiles a lot cheaper. And so this crazy thing happened where as the price of goods came down, people decided they wanted more of them because there was more variety of them. And so the overall spending of that category would go up. And so that actually meant that the people who were manufacturing it made more money. Does that make sense?
Nice.
So the cost would go down faster than the price would fall because, you know, they'd get
So profit per unit plummeted, but that actually resulted in greater profit overall, which is counterintuitive.
Yes.
And very cool.
Yes, exactly. And that's, we've seen this in Silicon Valley. We've seen it in all sorts of manufacturing things, saw it in food consumption. But then eventually you hit this plateau where people own enough clothes, you know? And so that industry starts to level off. Now, granted, it's at a higher level than it was when it first got started, but in terms of growth, that growth is no longer there. Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so as a result, what you start to see is even though the productivity has improved and, you know, and the cost per doing it's better, you start to see it regress yet again, and people start to lose jobs and you have an issue. And so this is a normal cycle that technology takes us through. And in this article, one of the things that he was saying is that as a result of it, there are certain industries where he says technology, it's a big lever for it. It's easier to disrupt technologically or improve at least. So manufacturing is a great example of that, where he's like, from a productivity standpoint, manufacturing in the U.S. it's way up there, higher than it's ever been before. And same with the textile work. And usually that is where you'll see those improvements. Now, here's where it gets interesting, is that the big fear, and he empirically says this isn't true, is that industries where they're what I would call labor intensive and hard to automate, they usually like, oh, we're going to get left behind. But that's actually not what happens. And so the example he gives is if you have like a burger flipping joint and I think this is what he, whatever, if you keep your wages low, you're going to lose him. You're going to lose employees to whatever that growing new industry is. Because again, if you think about like back in the textile days, because they're making more profits, they could pay their people more. And so anyone who was trying to pull from that same pool of workers would have to increase what they pay in order to stay competitive.
Okay.
And therefore, the company owners would increase their prices in order to afford the higher cost of labor. So it's this weird thing where there's this an improvement in one industry actually improves all related industries, which from a wage standpoint, if you're trying to buy it, you may not think so. On your perspective, and there's a term for it. It's like a Bernoulli principle or something like that. He gives a barista example. But anyways, one of the things that he says is happening in the United States as a result of all of this technological improvement is that human labor is actually becoming a luxury good, companies are starting to realize this. So for example, like Starbucks, they actually told their baristas to stop making multiple drinks at the same time. They went, because they said they don't want to reduce it down to a mechanized process. They want to maintain the romance of this is a handmade cup of coffee for you.
Oh my gosh.
and his point is, that's the direction we're going to head in, and just in general, because people will start to value that because everything else is automated to such a degree and so impersonal that, and their costs have reduced in all these other areas, it frees up money to pay for these more personalized services. And that's actually his hypothesis, is that we're not going to see jobs go away. Instead, we are all going to get into the our own little niche of some sort of personalized luxury service in a way.
I get that. I get where he's coming from. I do wonder, though, about the idea of what happens when nothing you can get from a person is better than an automated build version of it.
And I think you're setting myself up perfect for my second article, but go ahead and finish your thought.
Let's say, because the assumption there being that if like a handcrafted cup of Joe is going to be a better cup of coffee, that's the romanticized idea that it's handmade, individually processed.
Yeah.
The intention is there for this.
There is beauty in your imperfection.
It's true. But this is my question, and this is the thing that's difficult. It's like it's like when they first started artificially manufacturing diamonds. One of the big selling points is that they were perfect, which made them less valuable. So now they've started interjecting imperfections in order to create equivalent to natural diamonds in the way that the imperfections change how the diamond looks. So they're equivalent in almost every discernible way, except they're made artificially. So the question that I have is, can you get to a point when, or I'll just make the assumption it's possible, when you get to a point that the experience and the quality of the product is at least equivalent, if not better, than the human-made one.
Yeah.
What happens? You know?
What happens? Yeah, that's a great question. Well, and what do you do when you have people who grew up in an environment, in a culture where... I'm trying to make this work for the barista, but imagine a situation... Okay, all right. Real estate's a better one, right? You buy it from an agent. Now there's things like Zillow and Redfin, which are trying to disrupt it. What do you do when you have a generation of people who grew up going, I don't need to use an agent. If buying through a website's fine with me. And
Travel agents.
Travel agents, there you go.
that's one that's already that enough people grew up just being able to look up their own flights that travel agent industry is suffering bad.
Yeah, and maybe that's a good counterexample, because that was something that was considered human intensive, and for whatever reason, the travel agent, that in itself was not the experience you were going for, right?
Like, well, yeah.
You're working with them to do a vacation. You don't, if you could figure out a way to, I don't know, maybe that's the coffee thing, right? I want the coffee. How I get it is not important. And I that's the other thing, right? Is like, a lot of people are going to go the automated route, and that's okay.
Yes. Yeah.
You're not, you know, and so you are serving, it's, you are literally a luxury service provider. And so it's, and ideally everyone has a different thing that they consider luxury and are willing to pay for.
So the idea being that I am good at making my human cost labor luxury is that I'm good at designing robots for processing, but my desire is for live music,
right?
And by an actual person, but the person who makes live music,
but I may not care,
is going to be in the business of live made hamburgers and that daisy chain. So yes. The entire industry will be the idea here being that all of human industry will be supported by superfluous, not unnecessary things
that's
humans will do for each other because it's more fun to do it with another person.
But the things that will be, that are, we would say, critical, more important, all of that's going to be automated in the future.
Right. Which is,
yeah,
which is a good thing.
Yeah. You know, that's,
you know what I want to get into? This is only slightly related, but I just throwing this out there because I've been thinking about it. I want to get into automated maintenance.
What does that mean?
I want to, anything that needs to be maintained, I want to figure out how to get in the business of automating that maintenance. As I think that is going to be...
Let's talk about that. I got an idea.
Because I think that is going to be one of the largest industries in human history.
So like maintaining homes, would that be an example?
That would be a great example. Maintaining everything, the idea of how do we take what is and maintain it into the future without any human interaction. Because this is actually one of the most interesting, I think, that for all of its weird, fantastic aspects of the Foundation series that only really make sense in the context of the book, but don't make sense in the context of reality. I think the one that was the most interesting was that they live in this world where they built all these tools that, like, their power plants last for a millennia. And so everybody died and forgot how to take care of them. So they just eventually crash and like break. After eventually the automated tooling and the self-preservation of these things breaks down. And by the time they break down, nobody can remember how they work. Oh. And so there's all this technology that's really lost. But what I thought was really interesting about it was the idea that no, that's important. That's going to be a huge industry, and that's worth doing and getting into, because people forget how to do stuff every 40 years when the working population passes through. I don't know. It's an interesting idea. But anyways, I don't think that's off topic.
No, that's okay. The interesting part about this whole automation versus luxury thing is there are certain industries, I think the food one is a good one, that are sitting kind of in this tweener space. So there was another interesting article from The New Food Economy. I love this title. It says, restaurants to eaters, please, for the love of God, stop using Seamless. Now, Seamless is it's similar like DoorDash or Uber Eats, where it's an online service. You're hungry for some, I'm trying to think of an example, for a burger. That's not McDonald's. And so you log into the app and it tells you, hey, here are some good ones nearby. You order your food and it gets delivered to you. It's kind of the idea.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Super convenient. Totally like a come in, you know, a technological thing. It automates that entire process for you. It turns out, though, that the restaurants hate it.
Why is that?
Well, so the promise has been to the restaurant owners, we will increase your available market. And so just give us a cut of like 20% or more. Keep your prices exactly the same. Because could you imagine if your price was the same?
Yeah.
And you don't have the delivery charge. And then they're like, because we made it bigger, it's the exact same idea, right? Profits are less, but the market's bigger, so you'll make more money. That's the promise, which is exactly right. What we talked about. Well, it turns out that restaurant owners don't love it.
You know, it's funny you mention this. There's this place called, for a little bit of free advertising, if you're in the Bay Area, it's a small little pita restaurant. It's called Grab a Pita, and they do like shawarma and gyros and stuff. Yeah. And it is fantastic. It's as good as it gets in the Bay Area, in my opinion, for that sort of food. And my girlfriend lives 10 minutes from it. And she ordered through them through DoorDash or something.
Yeah, yeah.
For pickup. And when she got there, like they know us now because we go enough that they're like, we're customers. And they're like, yeah, if you could do us a favor and not order through them, because they take a huge cut. Like, just call us. Like, you have our phone number. We'll pick up. You can order directly.
Dude, that's exactly what I was going to say. Like, this one guy, he literally slips a note inside of each of his sandwich orders. That's like, it says, online ordering platforms such as Grubhub, Seamless, Postmates, Eat24, DoorDash charge us high fees that force us to raise prices. We do not like raising prices, so we're going to start the revolution against these huge companies located thousands of miles away who rob small businesses and customers of their hard-earned dollars. Soon, you will no longer be able to find us on these platforms, but if you order from our website, you can enjoy our food at our in-house fee-free prices. And then it goes along and gives their URL. But yeah, like, that's their, like, yay, thanks for expanding it, but no thanks. We want you to order through us directly, and we'll charge you with the real prices as a result of it.
Yeah, which makes sense to me. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's a bit of a golden goose situation. Everybody, you didn't want to be the one restaurant on the block that wasn't getting in on this because you didn't want to miss a revolution. But now that everybody is in on it, the restaurants are like, squeezed too hard, too big of a cut.
Yeah.
And yeah, they strangled it. Bummer.
Yeah, but that's an example of automation that just it's having trouble holding on. And I think the restaurants are, I don't know, I get it, right? We're going to try it.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is that it's automation in that it's a website. It's like classic computer science automation. It's just a database that two types that the customer can connect to, and then the company will connect, tell the restaurant, hey, make this food, and they'll get a delivery person to go. Like that little, like, but the actual thing that makes it expensive is the human labor of the person who drives to the restaurant, picks it up, drives to your home, delivers the food. Like they are incredibly expensive. It's the same thing that makes Uber impossible to replace. Like if you're going to be in, you know, I went to Kansas City this week and wasn't able to rent a car for work. It was like, yeah, when we hung out last week, James, I didn't know I was going to Kansas City.
Yeah.
It was a last minute deal, but wow,
cool. All right.
I was there for a quick second. But I wasn't able to rent a car while I was there because turns out I didn't have a, my license had expired.
Oh.
Yeah. So I had to Uber everywhere, which ended up being a little more expensive, but I was thinking about it. And I was like, honestly, like the Uber wasn't that much more expensive. It ended up being like $20 or $30.
They let you on a plane with an expired license?
I have my passport with me whenever I travel. Oh. I just keep it with me. And oh. so it's funny because because I know I have my passport, it's kind of like a mental check. Make sure you still have it. And so I always use that as my ID as I'm going to the airport. Huh. Sorry.
I'm just trying to make your story work.
I understand. It's all right. But I was thinking about the cost of Uber and how it's like, it totally makes sense why Uber wants to get into self-driving cars. Cause what makes it like the car for, I had three trips, one to the hotel, one to the fab, and then one to the back to the airport. Right. And it ended up being, it was like $120 in Ubers versus the $60 for the car, $20 for the insurance, and then whatever gas. So I estimated it was probably a $40 difference. And man, Uber, I would have taken the car from it. If Uber could come in and say, no, all that driving, we don't have to pay for a person. Like, we'll make it $40 for all of that equivalent driving. Would be huge. That would just be such a big difference. And it's like, it's that human cost is what makes it so expensive. Uber knows it. That's why they're working so furiously to beat it. And DoorDash suffers from the same problem. If a car drove up to the restaurant and the restaurant walked out and just put the food in this car, and then the car drove away, parked in front of your house, sent you a text message, you walked out, grabbed the food, and walked back in, it could make multiple stops. It had ovens built into it to keep stuff warm or cold or whatever it was supposed to do. And do all those things, then all of a sudden DoorDash and what was the other one you were talking about? Giving DoorDash Seamless. All this says Seamless. It gives them a cost advantage there where now they can say, we're going to charge you 2%, 3%. And now the restaurants are like, yes, we're going to have to raise our prices to compensate for it across the board. But now we're only raising our prices 1%, 2% across the board in order to have this fully automated delivery system that we don't have to manage. That's a huge advantage to the customers. The luxury good there, the expensive cost, is the human labor. That's the part that they're having a hard time automating. And that's the part that's going to be automated. Well, I think technically it already is. And we'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, I don't know. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. But yeah, just I think this is a constant struggle, I guess, dance that we'll see between automated and the labor force. So
I don't think
all the jobs are going to die, and I don't think we're all going to start working 15 hours a week either. But
I still think that I don't know how long it'll take. The timetable is incredibly hard to guess, but I do think this we've crossed to some sort of a threshold in the direction we're going that we are now heading towards a time where the pace of automation, the ability to automate automation is the way that I like to describe it. Well, it'll run away with it. And I do believe that, like you said, America's more productive than it's ever been. And yet labor participation is at historic lows, way lower than during the Great Depression. And I think that there's a correlation between automation, productivity, and labor involvement. But that's just me. To bring it to I'm going to try to make this a little less terrifying. No. And, well, different type of terrifying and a little more in the holiday spirit. So MIT announced a project they were working on. And, where they literally
not my
decided,
holiday, your holiday. The rest of the world's holiday, just to clarify.
MIT's getting into they're training an AI to scare people.
Perfect.
I know. Yeah, so just in time for Halloween and the presidential election. Good joke. MIT scientists have created an AI that makes image spooky.
think of the filter app Prisma, but with a monster spin. 3Person Gene created an algorithm called Night Machine that generates Halloween-inspired images from pictures of faces and places. It's not the first creepy AI. Google's Deep Dream is creating nightmare pictures since June, but basically what the idea here is this is the first time they're intentionally trying to make...
more than one doing it.
Well, Google... Yeah, see, this is... Google's like... Google isn't doing it intentionally with their deep learning thing. It's just making those, like, weird, trippy, like... really kind of strangely visceral images of that of where they're like they're running their deep learning algorithm backwards to generate images, and they look really weird and trippy. This one, they're intentionally trying to make it scary by teaching it how to like make things look like zombies or dead people or whatever. Which, yeah, seems really kind of fun in the spirit of Halloween, but also horrifying in the fact that people are already teaching AI how to try to scare people. Like, don't you see how this is? This is how it starts. This is what Elon Musk is talking about.
Oh, my gosh. MIT.
Oh, no.
So, guys, seriously. Oh, no. This is not helping. This is why we can't have AI.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we thought we could. We thought maybe it would take us 100 years before somebody designed an angry, terrible AI. Nope. Turns out it was the first thing we're going to try to do. Wonder what will happen if we make something that can terrify people.
It's like they don't even get that this is a tenuous time where, like, we need to do this right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's like I get the scientists' perspective. They're like, it's just looking for patterns and scary images and then replicating them. It's a cool trick. It's not that big of a deal. Like, yeah, but you can boil anything down to that sort of an innocuous claim. I didn't kill him. I just stuck a piece of metal that was sharpened inside of him. It was the blood draining out of him that killed him. Said the creepy like a clown.
Cool thing to do.
Exactly.
Yes, creepy clowns. Ugh, another meme in today's culture.
I was surprised. Last night was the big Halloween night of the year for the adults to go out and party. I did not see one creepy clown. I was expecting to see some, but I didn't.
I am so out of it. That was not at all what I did. Sorry. I fixed a roof, potential roof leak. I don't know if it actually did leak, but when I was up on the roof, I looked at it and went, that looks like it would leak. I'm going to go buy some tar and take care of this right now. It's like a big gash in the roof.
Oh, what?
I know. That was my Saturday evening. That's all right. Dude, let's get into the heart of this, because there was two big events that happened this week, and I would love to talk about both of them.
Me too. I want to get into it.
So, let's start off with Microsoft.
All right. What do you think?
Because they're Microsoft, just technically a day before, right?
Yeah, it was. It was first, so we'll let them go first. Also, it was better.
All right. I don't even have to do with that now. Well, let's just do the why. What do you think that? Like, what got you excited about it?
We should cover it a little bit. What happened? Right, okay, so right. I'm just gonna give the brief overview. So there's a if you're really curious and you want a lot more information, go to thefurlerbros.com. We're gonna have all the articles there specifically under the heading of /266. Yeah, and so the big thing was they had a Windows 10 creators update, which was what they updated Windows 10 to. They also introduced a new Paint, like the classic app Paint, but it does 3D now. And it's hilarious in that it's still really bad in the way that Paint is really bad, but way more sophisticated. It's hilariously perfect. It's like they got a team together and we're like, okay, we want to give this all modern technologies, but we want it to still be bad. And the team went, yes, I can get on board with this. It's pretty awesome.
It will be funny. Trust me.
Exactly. It's just perfect. They understand what paint is, which I think is a compliment. Windows VR, they announced.
Oh my gosh, this is big.
Virtual platform, a software platform to work with more types of hardware, which is pretty cool. They announced Xbox Live streaming, which is fine. They announced.
We're just quickly saying them all, right?
Yes, I'm just running through it and give us a framework.
All right.
And then they had Windows People, which was just that was dumb. But then they had the hardware stuff. So they started with the Surface Book i7, which is the latest version of the Surface Book. So if you remember, it's the one that is the clamshell, so it folds over like a laptop, but you can pop it off and flip it around, and it separates from the keyboard. They also introduced Surface Studio, which is an enormous desktop computer. Hear that, Apple? A desktop computer, a new one. It's a 28 inch pixel sense display, and which means it can use it's just like the Surface. So it uses the pen, it uses multi-touch, and it also uses the Surface Dial, which is this piece of hardware that you like set on the screen, and it works like a. It gives you. It's kind of. It's best to watch the video of how it works, but like it. Basically, the computer can sense when it's set on it, and then you can use it as like a dial to adjust things in real time. And they show it in conjunction with the dial and the pen going together, and you can do some cool stuff. So yeah, that's the overview. It's new software, new partnerships, and new hardware.
That's about as far as it gets.
Yes. So which one do we want to?
So. I think the VR headsets thing is kind of a big deal.
I do too. I want to hear your opinion on this.
Yeah, well, so right now we've got a handful of people offering VR headsets that are not cheap.
No, I mean, they are not.
And essentially, they've announced a partnership with HP, Dell, Lenovo, Asus, and Acer. We're all going to be making VR headsets that are all going to run the Windows holographic platform. And they're going to start, which means they will be more expensive, but they're going to start at $300, $299.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of like, all right, Sony's got theirs out there. Oculus is doing their thing. The Vives. The Vive. Right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
ACC Vive.
Yeah, thank you. The Vive's doing their thing. And now all these OEMs are gonna jump into the mix and put some cost pressure. I mean, we're watching the commoditization happen right now, just like what happened with Google's heads phones.
Right.
And it's gonna get crazy. It's gonna get affordable. It'll be interesting to see how good they actually are, because so far I've bought into the narrative that to do it well requires some pretty good hardware and is not cheap, especially when you think about like the sensors and the screens and things like that. And again, remembering my experience with Sony's VR, where even for me, it wasn't quite there yet because I still got a little sick. And so, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how you can make a $300 one that's okay.
So this would be my guess. I would guess the $300 ones aren't going to be.
All right. Well.
I would guess that they're going to be okay for certain types of people. If you're like I will probably be fine with it because I don't seem to suffer any form of motion sickness on this stuff. I notice when there's drift, when there's significant drift, but I can't tell when it just doesn't make me sick. I don't, for whatever reason, thankfully, I'm lucky. So it would work for me. But I think for people that are sensitive, what you're going to find is these absolutely do not work. I know. But the reason why I think it's such a big deal and why it's so exciting is because a lot of people look at VR headsets and think like they're these highly controlled systems. They need cameras. They need sensors. They need cables. They need power.
And cables.
And more cables. And they need
hardware, like they need specific types of hardware and quality of hardware. Like they need a bunch of different stuff in order to work. But the dream is that they would be like a monitor where they're universal. They can plug into anything and anything can plug into them and they'll start doing 3D content. Now, right. When I say the dream is that they'll be universal, I mean the dream for consumers. If the OEMs have any say in it, they don't want it to be, they want to lock you into an ecosystem. Yeah. Say, and this is what's so exciting about a company like Microsoft getting into it this way, is because for them, there is a huge advantage that as long as you need their software in order to run the hardware, then they win. And this is what Windows did to the personal computer back in the 90s. I mean, this is like the perfect company to do this, where they can come in and say, we're going to set standards, we're going to set software, we're going to deal with the drivers. We will be the duct tape that holds this whole ecosystem together so that for the end user, you just plug it in and it works. One of the directions that they're really focusing on, and this is something that the HoloLens does well, is what they call inside-out tracking as opposed to outside-in. So outside-in tracking is what the Oculus and PlayStation do, where they have cameras that track indicators on the headset, special, right. LEDs of different wavelengths. Technically, everybody calls the Vive outside in, but it's actually not really. What happens is the lighthouse things, they're these little light sensors that you like bolt into the walls, and they send out light pulses that the headset keeps track of. So the headset's actually doing tracking based off these really specialized light sources, and that's how it figures out where it is. That's a great way to do it, but it is expensive and complicated to set up as a result. Whereas Microsoft wants to go with, no, we're just going to have cameras and depth sensors on the headset. The headset will figure out where the room is around it and then do all of the motion, the 6 degrees of freedom based on that. That's how the HoloLens works. They have that, what they call the holographic, the HPU, the holographic processing unit, which is did that all with a hardware accelerated system. And by all accounts, it works all right. Mm. which I think is the biggest concern for me, is that they talk about how they're with the holograms on Microsoft's HoloLens system, they drift a little bit. They just do. And you don't get a sense of motion sickness because since it's a pass-through, since you get the rest of the world around you and that doesn't drift because it's real, you don't get a motion sickness, but you can see things flicking a little bit. And the concern is that the motion tracking is just not going to be high quality enough to keep people from getting sick. But the nice part is Microsoft is working incredibly hard and incredibly quickly to try to build out these hardware software solutions that other companies can leverage in order to get a working system. And I do think that there's a pretty good chance that Microsoft in a year or two or maybe tops three will have it to the point where HP can just announce a new headset and with better resolution and better cameras and everything, and you'll just bring it home and plug in the HDMI cable and you'll be off to the races. It'll work.
Totally.
One cable plug-in, that would be huge. Maybe two, one for power, one for HDMI. And then you can walk around. You'll have room scale depth sensing, automatically. Cool. Yeah, and I think that there's real potential here for some big disruption. And if I don't think Valve and HTC need to be worried, this HTC can be one of those manufacturers. They'll just pivot to that new hardware. Yeah. Valve is building an open source, not an open source, but building a platform that can work, that runs on Windows 10. Like it's great for Valve. That doesn't affect them at all. Sony has got their little ecosystem and they don't need to play nice with everybody else if they don't want to. Right. They'll still be successful. I think the one that
I think their biggest concern is that this platform, once it works, will come to Xbox, and then the Xbox will have this monster VR ecosystem going on.
Totally. That's a valid concern.
I think the one company that has to really be doing a double take on where to go from here is Oculus. They're not a multinational OEM. They are a very hardware-specific, niche-specific hardware manufacturer that has an ecosystem of products that works completely different.
Yeah, with a social parent.
Yeah, that's the one thing that they've got, that Oculus has got going for them, is that they can build out if they focus on the social internet portion of VR, there's definitely a space there for them. But if you work in the Oculus division, but if you work in the Oculus division, that is a real dark, future for you.
And you think about Zuckerberg too, like that software, they're going to want to roll out everywhere.
Yep. Oh yeah. Yeah. They want to be on every platform.
They don't want to lock it into a hardware, especially if it's not
you get that sense that Oculus just took like a year or two too long.
Yep. Oh, that's what happens when you're Palmer Luckey's issue is that it was a Kickstarter thing. It was he's going to be fine. Everybody's going to be fine. It's just going to be a footnote in history. Just recognize that. You know, it's not, this isn't going to be the future of.
It's a PDA.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. People will remember it. It'll go into, like, the Oculus will be in museums. Not the one that you can buy in stores, but, like, the early prototype ones. Because they proved it was possible. Like, and that's huge. But, it's not going to be the future. I think that's becoming pretty clear at this point.
Microsoft's just going to, oh, man.
Yeah, even, I mean,
Facebook
even
feels like they were semi-stabbed in the back. What?
Yeah.
E2 Brute? What?
Yeah. I don't know. I like you said with
Facebook.
But like you said, I got a feeling that Zuckerberg is like, "Oh, this is awesome." I think Zuckerberg is excited about it because he looks at it and says he thinks it's the future. He thinks it's a big deal and he'd love his company to be to set all the standards for the platform. But that's not the reason they want to do that isn't because that's how they're going to make money. How they're going to make money is data mining your social network as you use Facebook for all virtual reality interactions, which is what he really wants. So I don't know. I don't think Zuckerberg is going to be that angry. He might feel a little bit betrayed, but nah. What do you think about the Studio PC? A big old touchscreen that folds and stuff.
Sounds cool. It's a niche product, but you can still make a lot of money off of niche products.
Yeah. Well, and what I really like about it is that it's a niche product, but it's because people were complaining about how expensive it was at first. And you're like, it is
grand
expensive.
It's not
cheap. Yeah, it's something to scoff at. But the truth of it is, I think, that it is this platform that when you compare it to like artist stuff, specifically like what's it called, the Wacom tablets, where you know they're artist tablets, they work with pens. Those things are crazy expensive, especially as you get into like the higher end ones. But they're all for production artists. They're for people who actually work. They are real tools for real artists. And so the idea is they can justify these really expensive things. And this replicates a lot of those functionalities, but in a highly integrated way and therefore theoretically a better way. And really works well for artists, and in a way, it's the same argument that the iPad Pro was making when it came out. It's crazy expensive, but it's better than a Wacom tablet and costs less. And I think Microsoft is making the same argument here very effectively about what can be done with their platform at the ultra high performance end.
Yeah, I think it's crazy how oh, I forget how many years ago now. I honestly, I just want to go back like 10 years. Like Apple was the company that was known for creating hardware and software for artists. And now, and now Microsoft's going, oh no, that's going to be us.
Right. I know. Which is just it's an interesting for them. Yeah. It's a great market to be in because it turns it into an aspirational product. It makes it cool. Cool people use your products. One of the reasons why Apple is successful is because when you, as annoying and as much as people get made fun of it, and annoying as it is, when you walk into a Starbucks, everybody has their Apple, you know, MacBook Pro open and they're writing and doing
on their handmade lattes.
Like that has a real effect on the entire perception of your brand, and it improves your marketability everywhere because it gives you this perception. And I think that that's something that Microsoft's going for. They want to compete there because they realize that's the leading edge of their brand. And I think they're doing a great job. You know, I was just talking with one of my roommates today about the difference between Steve Ballmer and Satya Nadella. And it's just amazing how bad Steve Ballmer was, because these aren't new engineers. These are the same guys that have been working at Microsoft. It's not like he went out and hired a whole new team of artists. No, he said, we've got great engineers here, but we can make some, because the Surface tablet came out while Steve Ballmer was around. Like, these guys were there. This is just, it's one of those things where I think that Satya is willing to be a little bit bold, go out on a limb, and is willing to fail. It's just willing to say, let's make something great and see if people bite. You know, and I think that they have these engineers have a really good sense of what, and developers and whatever, the whole team have a good sense of what would make something great. No offense to Hewlett Packard, but they had their creative studio thing with like the camera and the projectors on the screen and like could do motion
tracking.
Yes, and it just seems so dumb. Even the first time I used it, it seemed dumb. This doesn't, because it's like it fits into what we understand. It's intuitive. Like, it's going to be easy for software developers to take advantage of the incremental improvements that they're making. And because basically it's just a giant screen touch tablet that works really well with a pen and this little dial mouse thing, which is another one where it's like, They might only sell a very, very limited few of them, but as a dongle, as a peripheral, a wireless peripheral, it works really, really well because it automatically syncs to whatever tablet you put it up against. The tablet figures out where it is on the screen and gives you contextual information. It's the dream of their Windows table things. Big old table. But it's like it's being done in a useful way at a price that's justifiable for people that, you know, can really use this tool. We talked about this a while ago with like, how do you innovate on tools? How do you make simple tools that we all use and add things to them to make them more effective and make our interactions with the digital world more effective? And I just think that this is as simple as it is. It is an example of Microsoft doing just that in a really in an impressive way. And I like Satya Nadella, man. He's a good CEO.
I can tell. I'm concerned you're going to get out of the Apple ecosystem when the opportunity comes. Given what I'm gushing about him.
I know. But this is the thing, though.
Okay.
You know what they didn't announce this week? A smartphone.
That's true.
You know, and I would say that's my big thing here is that from a software perspective, they have some hardware that really shows off what their software is capable of. They've got some great OS software, but their mobility lineup is, From a hardware perspective, is just not there. I mean,
well, are you also talking about their Surface Book, or you're just saying from a
home? Well, their highly mobile platform, their phones, it's literally non-existent. And then they, you know, the tablet market, they've got a good tablet, but they don't have a lot of penetration. And it's not the only tablet on them. It's not the only Windows tablet on the market that's a good Windows tablet. Okay. And the same with their Surface Book, where it's like, it's cool, it's good, it's got some cool features. It's not a slouch. It's a beast, but it's really expensive and it's got competition. It's definitely not a...
Yeah, that notebook is $2,400.
Yeah. That is not a joke when it comes to and I wouldn't, my first move wouldn't be to go and buy Microsoft branded hardware, but take from a
HP Elite. HP Elite? Yeah.
Maybe. I would,
come on, man, commit now.
I can say, look, if you can give me an employee discount, I will definitely put it on the list of possibilities.
I can get you an employee discount.
It's definitely on the list of possibilities. Right. Not making any promises.
Okay. Just commitments. That's all we need.
Here we go. You know, it's a, I don't know. I got excited, man. I didn't get done with this announcement and think, oh, this is a boring platform. Why didn't they do X, Y, and Z? They came out with that new commercial for the Surface Studio. It was awesome. Where it was like, it was the song that Gene Wilder sings in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, where he's like, no, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And no, which one is it? Which one's the Gene Wilder one?
Willy Wonka.
Okay. That's what I thought. And it's come with me and we'll be in a world of imagination. And it's cool because...
And you'll see into your imagination.
There we go.
Continue on.
And the idea... And they just show it. There's no words other than this song and just like swelling music. But they're like showing the components coming together and stuff. And I thought it was a very good commercial for just... showing like this is a cool thing. It has cool stuff. I don't know. I felt good about it. And I only bring that up because I'm going to contrast it with Johnny Ives' commercial. I get why they're pushing Johnny Ives' image. I think it's time to have him stop doing their stupid commercials where he's like,
he didn't do a commercial. So they have a video that tells about it, but then they also have a commercial.
Yeah.
An ad. I thought the ad was pretty cool, but
okay.
Maybe. All right.
I don't know.
Okay. Dude.
Let's talk about Apple.
You're done with Apple. That's interesting. All right.
I'm not done.
So it says you wrote here, or someone wrote here, Apple's seven biggest announcements. There were seven?
Yeah. I don't know.
There was one.
The Verge came up with seven.
Wow. They had to make it work, huh? Let's see here. They got the MacBook Pro 1, Touch Bar. Okay, is different. I feel like that's one.
Yeah.
Touch ID, which is part of the Touch Bar, which is part of the Mac.
Yeah.
Special application updates. All right. That's legitimately a new one.
That's different.
LG Ultrafine 5K display. I guess theirs. Apple sidelines the MacBook Air. Yeah, we're stretching it here. A non-announcement is a big announcement. Apple TV gets a unified TV app. And
that's kind of big.
That's it.
So there was four announcements. There was the MacBook Pro. There was the Apple TV app. There was the new software. There was the LG Ultrafine 5K display. And there was the whole, all of our other computers are terrible.
Yeah. All right. So what do you think of the new Touch Bar?
So the new Touch Bar seems pretty all right. It seems cool. Like, I get what they're doing with it. And I like because the argument for the iPhone was always, why do we make the entire touchscreen? Why do we make the entire phone a touchscreen instead of having a physical keyboard? Yeah. And the argument that Steve Jobs makes still holds, which is it's customizable. It can change. And the fact that it can change gives you all sorts of flexibility in what types of software you build, what languages you use, all stuff like that. I think that there is a real space to do that for the entire keyboard. Put, if not, OLED. Yeah, I do. I think
even with touch typing requirements.
No. I think what they're going to do, I think you are going to be able to, within 3 years. You can actually, you can already buy a keyboard like this, but you can buy a keyboard where all of the keys are customizable. Whether it's OLED, like each of the keys is an OLED key, or they're e-paper, e-book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Apple's going to go that direction. I think they're going to go with an e-paper for each key. So each key is customizable and they can change languages on the fly. You don't think so?
Nah. They'll keep with just the, whatever those are, the butterfly keys.
They just bought a company who builds those.
Nah, I at least definitely not in 3 years, but
man.
Sorry.
Well, okay. I at least think that there's a space for that. I think that it's not a crazy idea.
I think about, like, the argument is you don't do a ton of serious typing on your phone, and they have a keyboard for the iPads, and those are actual keys. Some would argue not great, but they're there. I don't know. I feel like someone who buys a computer expects there to be hard keys there. I could see where somehow they figure out how to make that touch bar bigger, but ever have it replace it? Man, that's...
Yeah, and they've got the fact that their trackpad is a giant touch screen, just without the monitor.
Yeah.
Huge. Yeah.
It is relatively big.
Yeah, I get the... I think the next thing they're going to do is add haptic feedback to the touch bar. That's the biggest complaint I've heard, is that there's no... It doesn't buzz or move or anything when you touch it.
Yeah, that's interesting. No. We've all gotten used to it now.
Yeah. So, and it's
the
funny, I watched...
jack too. Man, what a blast from the past. This entire device is...
Yeah, but that's... It's got two types of complaints.
All these new iPhone 7 users were like, I can't use my headphones with this computer.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's got four USB-C plugs and one headphone jack. And yeah. Well, I mean, the argument that Apple's making, and this is, it's funny because I understand there's right now, as we speak though, at the top of Reddit is a picture of a person who's got like, it's a MacBook Pro plugged in to a it's a MacBook Pro plugged into like a dongle that allows you to plug in your phone because you need to convert in order to plug your phone into it, and the iPhone 7 is plugged in, so he's got his headphones sitting right there because it's got the Lightning headphones, which can't plug into anything anymore. So it can't plug into the phone, it can't plug into the computer. And Apple's obviously making the argument of stop plugging things in. That wires are evil. Don't do that. And I honestly, I'm empathetic with the argument, man. The idea that it doesn't have a bunch of plugs, I still think is overblown. I think Apple's heading in the right direction. Because every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, that'd be so annoying. And then I remembered, so this is the perfect example. I went to Kansas City this week, and I took a ton of pictures at the fab of the machine that we're working on, and took like 150 photos. And I came back to the office, and I needed to upload them to our local server so that everybody could get them. And instead of plugging my phone into my computer, I just went on to iCloud and then selected all the photos from iCloud and then downloaded them and dragged them, dropped them into our server. That was it. I never plugged my phone in. Like, I never plug my phone in. And this is on bad internet. Like, I think that there is an... I'm always surprised by how often people plug their devices into stuff. And like, I know it'd be cool if this thing can plug directly into this thing. And I know there's like some irritation of that, but I think it's an overblown argument. And it's one of those ones that will wane more and more and more over the next couple of, you know, as we continue to cycle forward. I think the biggest one that I was actually kind of surprised by was that they ditched the memory card.
that is something that I think still has like a.
Yeah, I saw that. Which memory card did they get rid of?
So they had a memory card reader,
like an SD slot.
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Yeah, for like your camera, like yeah, like okay, one of the these. I'm showing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. The micro SD too.
Which I get.
Why is
that
a big deal to you?
Because I use it on my Mac all the time.
Oh. You know, like, your printer has one.
The printer does. That's funny. it's become a really good standard for swapping memory around. Whether it's from your phone to your micro, you know, to your Raspberry Pi to your device from here to here to here. It's just like. I would like to have the ability to swap physical data. Apple would just say, "Well, buy an adapter."
You mean like a USB stick, memory stick?
Yeah, but it's the thing that you can do with a memory card that you can't. It's easier to do it with a memory card than a USB stick. Is use it as bootable memory for like so. It's got some advantages over a USB stick, in my humble opinion. But I think that if you could just use it as like a Apple's going to make the argument of people, we know how much people use them. They don't use them often yep. enough to justify. So yep. we're not going to sacrifice all that space. I realize it doesn't feel like much space, but it's a lot of space when you consider everything else we're doing. And, for a function that's used,
they got to make it 20% thinner. Okay. Like, you don't get there by leaving things in.
Exactly. And their whole goal right now is clearly to say, we are going to maximize two categories and two categories alone, where performance meets mobility. We're focusing on those with a vengeance, whether it's the phone, whether it's the tablet, whether it's their computers, everything meets those two requirements. Make it more mobile. Make it as powerful as you can make it in as mobile a form factor as you possibly can, you know, and they've defined what their necessities are. 10 hours of battery life. That's all you need on a laptop, you know, 12 to 14 hours on a mobile device, whether it's your phone or your watch, you know, enough to get you through the day and then charge it at night, stuff like that. That's where they are on it. You know, ports just get in the way. You need more ports. You want more port expandability. Here's more port expandability. We'll give you a half dozen USB-C ports and just go to town with it. Which honestly is not a bad strategy, but I get where people are frustrated of like, oh, I can't plug my phone in. But seriously, how many people are still plugging their phone into their computers on a regular basis? Like
I don't think I ever have on my current phone.
And I'm not a big, like, everything, like, the best part about it is if you do it right, like, I tend to use quite a few of Apple's web services, but I use a bunch of Google's web services, and I use Dropbox, and I use, like, I have, like, a whole suite of different web services that all serve relatively the same function and for different, you know, unique use cases. And I just sit there and I'm like, and not to mention all of Microsoft's like document, you know, their productivity suite. Like I am just really surprised that people feel this. Like, I don't feel like I'm that unique of a user. So it shocks me when everybody's like, oh, I'm going to plug this in. Really? Like, I plug my things into power outlets. It's the only other thing I ever plug these stuff into. So yeah, I say all that to say
that too.
What?
Which I know you hate that too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we could get rid of it, it'd be great. But the other thing that's kind of cool about the touch bar, and this is what gets me excited about it, is that they tore it apart already, and it isn't being driven. I don't know.
I mean, I guess they were. You could order them on Thursday.
Maybe that's a really good point. I don't actually know how you do that. But somebody took it apart and actually looked at it. Turns out it's not being – the touch screen isn't being driven by the CPU. It's got a complete system on a chip. They're calling the T1, I guess. And it's essentially the Apple Watch processor.
Huh.
just driving it. And
makes sense.
Kinda, but kinda not. Why would you build an entire extra system on a chip to drive this thing when you've got an Intel CPU just sitting there roaring? It is one of the things that you, one of the reasons you might do it is because it gives you a different level of stability. It's just, it's a different CPU. It's a completely separate CPU running in the background, running in parallel. So it's able to handle tasks even when the rest of the computer has frozen, which can give you a certain set of advantages. It's a small change, I guess, from what the Apple Watch already has. So you already have most of your engineering like invested in it. It's not a hugely expensive thing to do, but it still seems like it'd be more expensive. It's like the trackpad doesn't have its own SoC. It's got a little bit of hardware that plugs directly into the Intel CPU that handles drivers and stuff. The reason why I think this is an interesting idea and why it's worth bringing up is because it clearly means that it's got its own RAM, it's got its own processor, and it's got access to all of the rest of the hardware in the device. I have a feeling that this is one of those, it's a classic thing that Apple's really good at. They got somewhere they're going, they have an idea, and they want to slowly embed hardware capabilities into the devices so that in 3 or 4 years they can introduce a new software suite and it'll be reverse compatible with stuff that's already out there. And you didn't even know.
What could that be?
One of the big things is that it literally can run when the rest of the computer's off. So will it be able to run Bluetooth and Wi-Fi? Like, there's no reason why it can't theoretically. It's got the antennas. So there's stuff like that. There's flexibility in what they're able to do by having it be a completely different computer embedded in the computer. Just kind of exciting. I get the feeling that they didn't do it because it was cost effective or because it was strictly in order to get to work, they felt like it was needed from an engineering perspective. It seems to be something that they were like, nah, it'll give us flexibility later on, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. The only thing I can think of is they build all the software and all the stuff using the other chip. And instead of redoing it all for the Intel chips, I don't know if that's a thing, but it sounds like it would be. It was easier to say, well, we'll just put another chip inside here. Maybe you're right. Maybe there is some other... There's phase 3 to this that they're preparing for.
I will say this.
Go out and get a new MacBook? Is it that
compelling?
Heck no, techno, huh?
The thing
what
that
about
gets me...
the 15-inch MacBook Air? Are you going to get that one?
Probably not. Okay. This is the thing that gets me. Is... The Mac Mini and the Mac Pro have still not been updated, which is just
That's
incredible.
True.
It drives me crazy that Apple at this point clearly is not just a mobile first company, but a mobile only company.
Yeah.
They're like, we only really focus on mobile products. And I get this sense that they are moving in. And I hate to say this about Tim Cook, because I think he's a good CEO and he is better than Steve Ballmer in a lot of ways, but it is very Steve Ballmer-esque in how cautious they are.
It does
not make any sense to me why it would be such a horrible thing to just upgrade the Mac Pro every year. Just don't give it a radical design change. All you have to do is keep it up to date with the most modern GPUs and CPUs out there. Like, how can you not afford to do that as a company? And the company is sitting there and saying, well, because we don't want to. That's not part of our design thing. Well, then get rid of it. Just stop. Like, stop selling it. Like, my Mac Mini works pretty good, but it is already starting to see signs of really not being able to run a full version of Mac OS, which means that there are people that are going to buy a Mac Mini this year that are going to get
a version of OS X that isn't feature complete. Which,
that's a good point. I haven't really thought about that. That makes sense. The minimum, everything should be able to run their software fully.
Right.
I'm on board with that.
And it just bothers me. Like, why would you do that? Why would you sell a $3,500 professional computer that doesn't keep up with the state of the art, like not even close to state of the art for capabilities when it comes to GPUs and CPUs on workstations? Like what Intel and AMD are doing right now with their processors, their GPUs are enormous, and they built a system that was impossible to upgrade. Like the Mac Pro is just toxic. And when you sit there and you go, like, why did Microsoft make the studio, the Surface Studio? It's because it's this leading edge of perception. Yeah, it's a small niche. It's going to make you price it so it makes money, but it's not going to make a huge amount of money. What it does is it starts the conversation at what the highest end capabilities are, and it gets the people who are really invested completely on board. And Apple, like, either get rid of the Mac Pro or update it. Like, I don't really care which one you do, but just be bold. Like, you talk about, oh, we're super courageous and we got rid of the headphone jack. Okay, you can spare a little bit of courage for the rest of your desktop lineup. Like, just say, we don't make desktops anymore. I don't know. I get the feeling that this is a company that's going down a road that makes me nervous. I still think they make the best smartphones and watches. I couldn't jump off board on those yet, but they're heading down. You know, it took 10 years before people just couldn't stomach Steve Ballmer's Microsoft anymore, and they replaced him with somebody who had a little bit of vision and wasn't afraid to gamble a little bit on stuff. And Apple just seems so unwilling to gamble on anything right now. You know, and they use the defense of, we're more proud of the things we say no to than the things we say yes to. But your engineers create amazing things behind closed doors, and then you say no to them because it doesn't fit some perceived image of your company. I don't know. And I just hear more and more people complaining about their devices, like the radio show that I listen to pretty much every morning. That every day this week, they complained about OS X and how they hated it and how it's ruining their phones. And which I think is stupid, but there's this perception that it's like,
specifically complaining about?
The one thing that they really hate is how they changed the lock screen. Now, why they changed the lock screen is an interesting argument. It's because they didn't change it forever because they wanted to keep this consistent user interface, even though everybody, like, people were switching to Google because it had a better lock screen set of features. Well, now they finally moved in that direction, and people who didn't care about it are complaining because, like, oh, it's different. I don't just swipe to unlock anymore. And Apple is in this weird place of, they didn't explain the change. They didn't make it obvious to new users of, hey, yes, we're changing it. You can go back to the old way. We'll let you do that. It's just one little button, and this is right. It's right here in the system menu. It's literally one step. You go into the system menu, then you go to lock screen, then you hit flip a switch. It's all you got to do, and you're back to what you always wanted. But and it's funny because these people are talking about how, like, these hosts are talking about how, like, their friends are saying, oh, Androids are so great. Like, they're really, you know, switching to Android was the best decision I ever made. And, like, Apple's trying to stop people from saying that, and it's making people say that. I don't, like, they're not messaging well right now. And you're seeing it. They had the first year of losses. I don't think that's just a coincidence of the marketplace. You know, they're selling less phones than they ever did. I don't think that's a coincidence of the marketplace. I think it's you can only grow for so long before you kind of stagnate in the market. And I just,
it's frustrating because you see all these things that just don't seem like they're working right. And it's the fact that I still can't get my stupid phone to open up Siri and not have it do the automatically close it thing right away.
That's like, pretty annoying.
I have no idea what I'm doing wrong. I feel like I'm not doing it right, and I can't understand why it always worked, doesn't work anymore. And I used Siri enough where that's starting to really drive me crazy. I don't know, man. Between just not keeping their product line up to snuff for inexplicable reasons, messaging in ways that don't make sense, and I think just overall acting with way too much caution. I'm nervous. You know, I'm nervous that they're just not taking bold enough steps. They're not getting crazy. They're not taking risks.
Yeah, and it's like what we've talked about before, where Tim Cook isn't a visionary. He doesn't have that. He doesn't have a clue as to where things are headed and where they're going.
Right.
And the touch bar is one of those where it's like, that's cool. And I get the idea of function keys were old, let's replace them. But that was the extent of the thought.
Right.
You know, I know that you are like, they're using a separate system on a chip and it means they're hinting for something greater and they're setting us up. Honestly, they may not be.
Yeah, you're right. I'm being optimistic because I want to be surprised.
Was a day and age? Yep, totally on board with you. Nah, I doubt it.
Yeah. I worry that that's the answer with the dual. I know that's not the answer with the dual lens camera. But there's this like growing like worry in me that no, they really thought it'll give us the bokeh feature, and that'll be really great. It'll be good. Do you not understand what you have? Like that's a great example. They put the hardware out there and they're just being really, really cautious about what they want to do with the software. You know, we want to make sure that everybody knows exactly how to use it.
I'm just trying to figure out what all those people are doing. I mean, I get that, like you talked about at the very beginning of the show, like your idea of having a automating maintenance. It's kind of like that's what they're doing. Maintaining the devices. It requires exponential engineering work to add a new feature because all the original ones are busy improving the existing things. We got to make a better button. We got to make a better screen. We got to improve the airflow. It's like all these things where it's like from an end user perspective, like, okay, great. Yeah, it's thinner device, lighter. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I suspect that you're talking exactly what it, you're making. Your point is exactly it. The first time you cut the device by 20%, it takes 10 engineers. The 10th time you cut the device by 20%, even though like the first, like the next 20% is almost unnoticeable to the end user because it's so small by that point. But it takes 1,000 engineers to do it. So it takes exponentially more engineers to do exponentially smaller tasks and make smaller changes. And then it's like, oh, we want to do, you know, we want to make a feature, but we have to add, but because we've got like messages on all these different platforms, we want to add balloons effects to our messaging app. And because of that, just updating Messenger becomes this enormous task. You have to do it on so many platforms, and you have to do testing, and you have to do reliability, and you have to run through all the different, like, oh, is this a usable feature? Is this not a usable feature? And then you finally run it up to the CEO, and the CEO goes, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure how much business is going to make for us. Maybe we should be a little more cautious about what changes we make. And you end up with like some cool new features in iMessages. They're not, you know, they don't go unnoticed. We use the ha ha thumbs up feature all the time in our different threads. And, you know, it's not bad.
It's funny the way I like it's used all the time because it's super straightforward. Take a message, tap and hold it, push it, whatever, and then it gives you the option. It's for if there's any other stuff like to use the stickers or whatever we call them now. I'm like, you gotta want it to use those because it's buried in there, and it's one of those where you're like, yeah, feature rich, but not easy to use. So I'm not going to that often.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. And then you got other stuff where it's like Apple TV. The thoughts the opposite. How do we streamline everything? How do we get it all to the forefront of you with like with their new unified TV app, which is someone who doesn't watch a ton of TV and really only watches Netflix, which it doesn't work with Netflix. I'm like, oh, okay, cool.
So there's the Comcast app on my phone is actually really cool. I've used it a couple times because the Comcast that we're subscribed to has like we've got everything, like every channel, every Stars, HBO, like we've got. Yeah, I know. I don't pay for it, so I don't care. I should say it comes complimentary with my rent. So I don't have a say in it. I'm not going to worry about it. And honestly, I use it enough where it's fine. But I actually watch enough HBO where I'd want to get HBO Go or HBO Now or whatever the other service is. All of a sudden, it wouldn't save me any money. But I do really, back to what I was saying. So that main Comcast app is pretty cool because you can just type a movie or TV show in it and it will tell you what service it's on. If it's one of the streaming services, if what channel it's on, like it's just it is a one-stop shop and it'll tell you where to go to find it. And, their app is just really clunky and ugly. But it works well enough that I use it. Whereas I think with the Apple TV, that'd be pretty cool to just be able to walk in and say, hey, I want to watch this show. Tell me how to watch this show. I don't want to have to jump from service to service to service looking for a show. Just give it to me. The only thing this is missing, it sounds like, is Netflix. Or that's the big one it's missing.
Yeah.
And which is a big one to miss, but eventually it won't, they're working on it. They're figuring it out. I can't understand why Netflix wouldn't want to be, well, that's not true. I understand why Netflix wouldn't want to be there. Cause they don't want to be thought of as just a competitive channel. They want you to jump into Netflix and stay in Netflix. But yeah. I think it's a short-sighted vision. So I don't know. You know, it's obviously it's still the biggest company in the world. They're still doing big business. I think their mobile platforms are as good as you can get. But
true. I agree.
I get less and less excited about Mac OS. You know.
So are they.
that's the problem. That's what drives me nuts.
Craig still knows how to give a demo though. Oh my gosh, that guy.
I know, he's awesome.
So entertaining.
I know, he's good.
He could be there in a Clippy and it would work.
I know, right? I do want to mention this, James. This is an app that I got. It's pretty awesome. It's called Duet for iPad.
Okay.
Yeah, it works on OS X or Windows. You download an app, then you plug your tablet, whether it's your iPad or iPad mini or iPad Pro or whatever into your computer and it acts as a second screen. So if you have like an iPad Pro,
but you have to plug your device into the computer.
Yeah. Over USB.
Like a child.
Yes.
Okay, that's cool.
Over USB.
I just remember you earlier, you talking about how horrible that was.
Yeah. Well, okay. Sometimes it has its advantages. Okay.
All right. All right.
Ideally, yes, it would do it wirelessly, but it doesn't so we'll deal with it. But what's really cool about it is that they just had a big update. And this is where Apple's doing all right still. They had a big update that allows you to use your Apple Pencil with it. So it acts like a Wacom tablet now for depending on what artistry app you're using, which is pretty cool. And I don't know. It's pretty nice. Get into it,
so
James.
So what are you doing on it? Like, are you hooking up to Photoshop or like what? How does it?
Yeah, it's literally like you'd open up Photoshop on your.
So what if I don't have Photoshop?
Well, I don't know.
What if I have Pixelmator?
Yeah. Sure, works fine. But the idea being that, like, you would just, you could open it up onto a full version of Pixelmator powered by your GPU, and now you've got this really amazing touchscreen that goes with it, as opposed to just running it on your iPad. The joke of this being that your iPad Pro has almost as much processing power as some of, has more processing power than some of Apple's laptops.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't even know why I brought it up. I like the app. That's why I brought it up.
All right. Yeah. Cool.
So,
put you in charge of the cover photos.
Yeah. So there's a big deal this week.
You want to do
big
it? Little... You want to use your, want to use Duet? Draw a little picture for us?
No.
I'll let you do
my
it.
iPad. My iPad can barely function.
So you got the app. But okay, alright.
Well, as a dual, as a second screen, it works pretty good.
Gotcha. Okay.
But not for interacting with it.
Not as an actual like Wacom replacement.
Right, yeah. No, mine is terrible for it. Okay. Good.
Got it. Yeah. I understand though.
But
unload that particular job, but that's cool.
No, sorry about that.
I had Jesse draw for us last week. Oh, but nice. You didn't even notice.
No wonder it turned out so good.
Yeah, it did.
So this week there was a kind of a cool event. I don't know, unless did you have anything else you want to say about Apple before I move on?
No. I would like you. I was like, I said at the very beginning, right? We're like, there were 7 things they announced. I was like, really?
Yeah.
I think it was 1. All right, maybe 2. But, yeah, whatever. I was kind of shocked that they did not. I was hoping for, obviously, a new Apple TV. It did not happen, though they obviously talked about it. I was shocked to not see anything about the iMac or the iPad Pro.
I know. I just. Yeah, that's right. The iMac. I forgot about that complete computer lineup that they didn't update with even new GPUs.
Which, more, like you said, why not at the very least, like, just give us some spec bumps, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be simple. New or interesting. Just, boom, it's faster.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, don't change the prices. Just allow us to buy more. It's just driving me crazy. Yeah. Whatever. We got listeners right now just saying, then buy a Windows. It's upgradable. See, my problem is I like the company. It's not about what products I want to buy. So Uber had a cool accomplishment this week, particularly the company that they bought, Otto, which is a subdivision within them. They delivered a bunch of Budweiser this week.
Cool.
Which doesn't seem like it should be that big of a deal, except that they did it in their automated trucks, and the truck drove itself for the vast majority of the journey.
Cool.
I know. So Otto's whole deal, we talked about it a while back, is they're building systems that can be integrated into existing semis. So they did their first test run of it, where they delivered the actual product, and they had a trucker, or the driver, who navigated it from the plant to the freeway, then let the truck take over.
Mm-hmm.
Drove itself to the end destination, where it delivered a bunch of Budweiser beer. And it was a 120-mile beer run. Not bad. Pretty cool.
Obviously, it didn't crash. That's good.
Yes, it made it. One of the really cool things about it is that Budweiser's like got really into it, and they put both logos on it. The beer cans that you can buy have like a little Otto logo on it, and it's like delivered by a self-driving truck. I mean, like, Budweiser got into it. I know. I was kind of surprised too. Pretty big deal. Pretty big first step. We've always said it. Like, the thing about truck drivers is when it comes to improving, consumers and truck drivers are completely different beasts. Because consumers, you got to make it look flashy and make it seem cool. Just being, you know, cost isn't the only motivator. It's not a simple equation to get people on board with self-driving cars. Whereas with self-driving with truckers, like, the question is so much easier. It's just what's the ROI? And they will take into account of the risk of what happens if an accident is caused by one of these things. They will take into account the how much the system costs to integrate and set up. They will take into account how much they save by not having the driver be in the truck or have to be doing anything. Like, they'll just take all these things into an equation and they'll ask, what's the ROI? And if the ROI is right, then they'll invest in it. And once you get to that line, it's just going to be a sweeping change, I think. And the fact that Budweiser is this into it tells you how much potential there is in the market for not just trucking companies, but companies that rely incredibly heavily on transportation via semis. This is some potential to be huge, I think.
Yeah, sounds like it. Because they ship a lot of product around the world. And you know, if they're looking at it, everyone else is looking at it too. And interesting. That's exciting. Congrats to Uber.
Yeah.
Tesla's got to be like, we got to finish our truck.
Yeah.
So, this is a thing. We were so right.
Which brings me to my next point. Tesla had a pretty good week this week. They announced...
Oh, look at that. I didn't even see that.
I know. They announced a whole bunch of new stuff, including new tiles, a profitable last quarter, and all sorts of stuff for Tesla. It was awesome. But the one that I thought was really worth bringing up this week was just kind of a throwaway statement in the middle of the financial call where I'll just read it. During the earnings call, Musk was asked to explain whether his proposed car sharing network, dubbed the Tesla Network, would generate revenue for Tesla or help Tesla owners offset the cost of their vehicles. In response, Musk made some cryptic comments about the scope of his so-called Tesla Network, which, by the way, if you remember correctly, they announced wouldn't work with Uber. You wouldn't be able to use it with Uber. And what he said was, Musk said, people have been characterizing this car sharing proposal as, quote, Tesla versus Uber or Lyft or something like that. It's not Tesla versus Uber. It's the people versus Uber. There was no follow-up question, so Musk's statement was left hanging like that. What? What does that mean? Nobody knows what that means. And which gets me excited because that's the sort of thing that he'll throw out there. Nobody will follow up on. He feels no need to follow up on and explain. And yet, like, this is now going to bug a bunch of people. And sometime in the next couple of months, he's going to be in an interview and somebody's going to ask him specifically about it. And he'll just answer the question, whatever it is. Maybe like, well, Uber's an evil company, so, you know, we don't want them to succeed. He'll say something like that. I'm like, I really want to know what he's thinking at this point. Like, well, what do you mean it's the people versus Uber? I do think that his rationale is that Uber's goal is to become the one-stop shop for all transportation. Like, they want all cars to be owned by Uber. They want all transportation to be run through Uber. They want Uber to be this, like, monolithic, all-encompassing corporation. And they're quite open about that. And that's not me being a conspiracy theorist. And I think Elon, in his continual quest to save humanity from themselves, thinks that a company like that is dangerous.
And the only way to fight them is to democratize it and to make it so that everybody can work together and everybody is a co-owner and there isn't a single monolithic owner of anything. That's his strategy with fighting artificial intelligence. It's not to get companies like Google to stop owning it or to stop having artificial intelligence. It's to democratize it so that Google isn't the only one that has anything that everybody uses. And yeah, he's an interesting character, man.
I like him.
I know, me too.
He is an interesting character. That's so awesome. He's just, talk about someone who like, that could go either way too, where like it's super purposeful statement.
Yeah.
Intentionally vague or not at all.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
and I feel like it's one of those two.
But yeah.
I don't know. He just likes a free form. I love it. Whatever.
Did you watch him unveil the new solar tiles?
No.
Roofing tiles? Oh my gosh. It's hilarious because it's 15 minutes and it is the exact same tone cadence of the giant Mars SpaceX announcement.
Oh, yeah.
Where it seemed unplanned, unscripted. He'd show stuff and be like, well, that it's not actually great on this slide. But anyways, I'll just tell you what it is. You're like, how did you not plan this, man? This is like the big announcement for your company. You've collected an entire crowd to come and see this. Like, what are you doing? And yet, like, he just comes across as like, he's just logically laying it out. It's a very professional, like it's like a very earnest, like laying out of his logical argument.
Just like, why this makes no sense. Tiles that look good have 98% of the efficiency. We think we have a way of at least hitting 100, maybe even more efficiency with letting light bounce around. I know it sounds cool. They look good. We've got four different styles. It's kind of awesome. And we figured out a way to make it to make it the same price as the current roof installation. Plus, you know, you'll get paid back over time. So it's actually a better deal. This is an obvious buy, right?
Right. I mean, like, exactly.
That's the pitch.
Exactly. We always say the thing is, that you said it with less stuttering. You were more succinct than he was. And he's, I don't know, he's also hilarious too, because he likes to pepper in the whole, oh, by the way, humanity is destroying itself and this is the only way to not end in a catastrophe.
You know, he's got his why. I love that about him.
Yeah.
And this is the exact complaint, to bring it back, that we have against Tim Cook and Steve Ballmer. Where I think Satya, even though he hasn't, maybe it's not as crystal clear as Elon Musk, which his is like, we're killing ourselves and I'm trying to slow that down and avoid it. Or at least say, Earth is a lost cause. Let's give ourselves time to get out of here. Like, that's his central thesis. That's his why. That's his guiding principle. It's very crystal clear. And he brings it up because like that it's relevant to what he's doing. That's his singular narrative.
He's got a clear mission statement in everything he does.
Yes. And whereas like with the Apple's thing, you're like, well, why did you do this? Where are you going with these? Why does it make sense to update the Macs to the MacBooks today, but not the iMac, not the Pro, not the, what garbage computer do you have again? It's the mini. You're welcome. You know what I mean? Like, what's your guiding overall principle behind this? Why did you get into the watch? Why are you not in VR at the moment? What do you see? I don't know. We're missing that from Apple, whereas Elon Musk clearly has it. And so when he makes disparaging comments against companies like Uber, you're like, okay, this feeds into his thesis somehow.
Right. Yeah.
Because otherwise he wouldn't care.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't care about competition, or he doesn't act like he cares about competition. If there's competition and he doesn't
make fun of Blue Origin.
Right.
Whatever.
You would say the only time he was frustrated by Blue Origin was when they were chastising him because they accomplished something that SpaceX hadn't. And SpaceX was doing something so much harder. Like, they were just like, you jerks, stop being jerks. Why can't we all just do this together? Like,
And he goes after reporters and journalists when they attack his driving cars and right. say they're not safe or whatever, because, you know, he's protecting that concept, that idea again. So I come back at it. We're like, clearly Uber's done is or it's not obvious to us, but it yeah. is to him, to the point where he doesn't have to explain it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How do you not understand what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is funny. Which they say, like, that's the thing about you know, people who are disrupting the world, like, they don't see it as a disruption. It's just an obvious logical step.
And man, that is I don't like that feeling, because I'm like, everybody wants to be that guy, and it's just like,
oh, yeah,
well, to feel like how, you know, you like. You want to be disruptive, and to like know that you never really get that feeling. You never get to be the person that disrupts, because the person that is disrupting doesn't understand that they're being disruptive. And
I think that was part of the magic behind Steve Jobs, was he somehow sat in both camps.
Yeah.
Where he went, this is clearly the logical pattern. We're headed here. I've got that vision for it. But at the same time, recognized that he was blowing our minds.
Yeah, but yeah, that was the magic distortion field, the Jobs distortion field. That was
because I think that's the thing that Satya is missing at the moment. Because I think he's got that vision and where it's going, but he's still in the this is a logical progression of where we're headed. Well, and I think Google does that too. Yeah. And it's like no, you need to understand, like, this whole AI thing. Make it a bigger deal than what it is. Yeah, figure out a way to show me it's a big deal.
Yeah, I'm coming around.
Texting app that doesn't interact with anything else.
All right. Jeez. The more I talk to people about what IBM, what Microsoft is doing in the machine learning and artificial intelligence department, and I see the rest of like the cool products they come out with, I think there's a real like cool product brewing in there. Like, if all of these different engineering teams that are doing all this great, amazing work at all these different levels are the same types of engineers that are doing their AI stuff, and they just don't have a product they can show us yet, I think that's going to be huge. especially because they've made such giant investments of it, both in hardware and software. And I think there's real potential. By the way, this is apropos to the conversation. Sure, I'll bring it up. Okay. I've had this thing for like 5 years.
It's like an ugly CD disc. What is it?
It is a learning board that I bought from Kickstarter. That is an FPGA learning board. So it's like you can. It's got a field program.
Wait, I know this because this will be like third week in a row we've talked about it. Mm-hmm. The forced programming. I don't know, what is it? It's the one where you can reprogram the chip, right?
Yeah.
Field
programmable gate array.
That's the one.
Yeah,
I remember it.
There cool. we go.
That's exciting.
And it's So I finally.
It's not a production thing. It's a learning thing. You said.
Yeah, this one's a low end one designed to just kind of learn the software and stuff. And
awesome.
I went online to get how do I actually start using this and set it up? The website's gone. Oh, I waited too long. So I gotta. I think it's all there. I know it's possible. So it's going to be one of those, I got to learn how to learn moments, but
excellent.
Speaking of a company who's figured out their reason for existing and is making moves according to it. This is the last story for me today. I don't know how much time we have.
I think we're good. 15 minutes, okay, cool. 10 minutes.
Cool.
What are we?
So,
yeah, sure.
Sure. So Twitter has announced this week that they're going to shut down the old Vine.
You mean sell Vine to someone who can actually use it?
No, they're going
to... You mean invest in it and pivot it to something useful?
Why? Just because it's still a
you mean
large,
integrate
successful
it into their other, yeah,
mindshare platform?
I don't know. I feel like shutting down is not the best option.
So I read an article because it laid it out. Great. My thoughts.
All right.
And on why they were not going to sell Vine. And it's
I'm gonna read the article almost word for word because it does such a good job. There's so many ways Twitter could end up looking like a fool if it gave up control of Vine, and it would rather bury the app than sell it. There's little to gain, a lot to lose. So in the spirit of Vine, I'm going to break down the reasoning to 6-second snippets of text. It can preserve all the existing vines, so tweets and embeds with them don't go dead. Whereas if it sells it to anyone else, it might break or delete the archive. So,
okay,
they keep the history of it, which is an okay argument
to get around that. You could mirror it all and whatever. Anyways,
yeah, and you could just do that contractually. There's too much brand risk involved if someone else owned a product everyone associates with Twitter. And if the new owner resold it to Pornhub, which turned Vine into a smut garden, which I don't think is that big of a deal. But
I agree.
You know, but it's part of this whole thing. With Vine's traffic so low at the end, the sales process might have been too costly and distracting to Twitter to make the little cash it's going to make back worth it.
That should be bullet number one.
I think that's a real legitimate one. This is another one. If it did sell for a low price, it would embarrass Twitter by implying it was desperate for the cash just to keep the lights on, which is another, like, from an investor perspective, like, I think it's a risk. You're taking, it's a legitimate risk. Vine's account system was bootstrapped off of Twitter's. Selling it could give owners too much ability to clone Twitter's core user graph and building a competing product, which there's some legitimacy to that. There's probably a lot of
IP. Sell it to the right person, but okay.
I know. If someone else bought it and made it more successful, it would demonstrate the ineptitude of Twitter's leadership and their inability to harness Vine's potential.
I disagree with that. Think about LucasArts, right?
Yeah.
Think about Marvel.
No. I would argue that that's exactly what you're talking about, is that LucasArts was showing some ineptitude under their leadership.
Well, yeah, but own it, right? And he goes, look, I could not do what they've been able to do. I'm so excited to see it thriving now under new leadership. I was more interested in seeing its success than my own ego.
Then, okay, I totally hear what you're saying, but Twitter's trying to survive as a platform, not completely sell out like Marvel or LucasArts. I mean, Lucas completely cashed out. Marvel was completely bought by Disney. So the success of Disney...
Not completely.
No.
We're kind of missing a web-slinger and a Wolverine, but...
Well, yeah, but like Marvel.
I know.
Marvel Studios.
I know. I just like to point out they don't own quite everything yet.
Yeah. They're slowly working their way back into it, though.
Oh, I know. I saw the latest.
I say, it seems what clear is it? That.
There's 2.5.
Even like they're, it's what's his name's last outing as Wolverine in the new Logan movie.
I saw the trailer of it.
Huge Axeman.
Looks good. It's funny. I'm glad they came out with that because I was kind of figuring out, like, man, when are they going to put a fork in this one? Like, he'll reach a point where either A, he literally is too old and now he looks like he's aging, which is an issue, or B, like, he just gets tired of it. And, like, how do you do what they did with the Dark Knight series, you know, with Batman, where it's like, all right, we're going to close this up. We're done. We set it on the side. It's its own thing. Cool.
Right.
And they figured it out.
Yeah.
I wonder too, like, clearly, like, Disney's got a long-term plan for these things. And I just wonder about for X-Men, like, it doesn't feel like it.
No.
They've got a longer vision. But so it's like with this Logan movie, like, man, it seems good. But at the same time, how much was it, they talked him into one more movie, and he was like, yeah, I'll do it. Or, you know what I mean? As opposed to saying, like,
when they came out with the first
Wolverine movie, they were like, all right, we're going to do a couple things, and we'll do your Logan thing. It'll be good.
If I had to be totally honest with you, this is the deal. Bryan Singer owns, like, the entire X-Men universe. Like, he and Fox, they, like, work together, and he does pretty much everything. And like, the side movies are disjointed and almost exist in a different world. Like, Wolverine... the Wolverine movie, it like
it doesn't line up at all with any of the timelines. That one was weird. Well, and it's like, and it's just this, it's, that's there. It's funny when you like look at quote unquote the timelines, like that's just the case. It's like none of these things line up with anything else. Like they're all over the place, which is weird and confusing and strange to deal with. But it's one of those things where I think they're getting to the point where they're in talks with Disney about, okay, this, if Spider-Man works out, how do we do what Spider-Man did, where X-Men only movies we control, but we make with creative, you know, oversight by Marvel, but we make them, we make all the money, and then you get to use these characters in cool. Avengers movies. I'd be right. And as a result,
Wolverine in an Avengers movie.
Oh. Yeah, because this is the deal, is that Hugh Jackman, like, the X-Men movies aren't X-Men movies. They're Hugh Jackman movies by and large. It's
true.
And it's like the rest of the movies in this entire world are like, those are the side movies. They're not the main course. They're all built around this Wolverine character, and Hugh Jackman has embodied that so much that it's like,
happened, right? They like, they came out with, what was it? The first X-Men movie.
Yeah.
And he like, he was super smart, right? And saw that opportunity and went, I'm going to take this. And they were talking about how, like, by the time the second one came out, like, they were like, he's Wolverine. That's his thing. And he like, he got physically fit for it, mentally fit for it. And then I think from then on out, they're like, we have to, like, we just, you know, like the directors wanted him in it and everyone loved him so much in it. They're like, we have to keep him somehow entangled into it. And then, yeah, eventually it becomes kind of a thing, which I thought that was the how it should have ended, or what did they do after the credits thing where they got done with Apocalypse and Professor X was like, guys, we need you for another one. They're like, whatever, just call Wolverine. It's about him anyways. We know it.
Yeah. And they just, I think what they're leading up to is that before you bring any of the X-Men into the Marvel universe, you need a younger Wolverine in order to.
I agree.
And so it's like, how do you wrap up the Wolverine like saga? And this is the point I was going to get to is you made it sound like Hugh Jackman was like, fine, I'll come back for one more. And I think it was more of a fine, I'll only do one more. You know, it was,
I do think he loves it.
Yeah, I do. He bought the, like, part of the genius of Hugh Jackman was not just that, like, he did it and was great at it, but he bought the rights to be Wolverine in any Wolverine movies. They were like, that's part of the deal, is they couldn't recast him. He liked the guy that much. And so it's been a match made in heaven. And I think it was sort of a compromise with him of like, we'll do the old man Logan storyline. We'll do it right. We'll give you like a great send out. It'll be a great movie. And now they're like, we'll make it R, so it's really crazy and, you know, and nuts.
And you can still own the rights, you just won't be in it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But we're gonna cast it. That'd be so funny if he gets to like, Disney's like they're casting for a Wolverine, and they have a guy who does a great job, and everybody's like, this guy's really good, really good. And then Hugh Jackman's just like in the shadows in the corner, is like, no, I don't like him. Get another.
I have a funny, he's a cool guy.
He would,
if someone could genuinely do it justice, he would get behind it.
Yeah.
That's funny. Oh man. So sweet. Love it.
Same.
I love it.
This has not been a 6-second discussion of Twitter and getting rid of Vine, but
you know, it just like Vine, that conversation about it was fleeting. Not meant to last. Oh well. Well, man, good stuff happening on the tech front this week. Pretty good. Before we, like, everyone's getting in their last things before the holiday season starts up. That's what's happening here.
Yeah,
I like it. I like it. And oh my gosh, I just thought my computer froze. I was about to freak out. But we're good. All right, everybody. Thanks for watching us, and thank you so much for listening to episode 266. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes with all the links at furloughbros.com. It's going to be episode 266. And if you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, just do it. Email right to your inbox every week. It's super easy. All the links will be there. Finally, this podcast is supported by listeners like you. If you would also like to contribute, we have four different levels. We got fanboys, nerds, junkies, and mavens, and they all have their own different levels of rewards. Awesome rewards, I may add. And so you can check all that out at furloughbros.com. Okay, let's see here. I am James Furlough. My scary brother is Matthew Furlough, and we will talk next time.